Well, hello everybody and welcome to another episode of GUcast. This is Declan Murphy, urologist here at Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne, joined as ever by my co-host Renu Epen. Hello, Renu.
Hello, Declan. Great to be back.
Great to be back.
You just whipped off your headphones.
Did you see that? For those of you watching on YouTube.
It doesn't feel right without the headphones.
Have we ever done a podcast without headphones?
I don't think so.
So the reason we're doing it without headphones is for, I think, the first time in the last 60 episodes, we don't have an external guest dialing in on Zoom.
It's almost like COVID doesn't exist. We're all in the same room.
So we're here in the studio with no headphones on, but you're coping okay?
Yes.
Just.
Yeah. So, and well, the reason we don't have an international guest dialing in is we've got a fantastic guest who's joining us in studio who we'll introduce in a few moments. So that's great. We can go nude with no headphones on and so on. But it's great to have the studio back together. We've had a break for a few weeks. I've been overseas, which I've now realized if you go to Europe for a few days, it takes a couple of weeks to be allowed to get back into the hospital, even with quarantine restrictions lifting and all that sort of stuff. But there you go. So look, what we want to talk about today is, of course, a favorite topic of ours. It's prostate cancer, of course. But within prostate cancer, PSA testing, probably something we don't talk enough about, the vagaries of PSA testing.
Absolutely. I mean, we use it so much. I mean, now, like you were saying offline before, you know, we have kind of an array of tools to assess clinical risk, PSA being one of them, but it can be a source of great anxiety for patients and doctors.
Yeah, and we understand limitations with PSA testing as well, of course, and that's why we tend to, of course, have strategies like a multivariable approach to early detection, you know, to correct for the fact that PSA on its own is not much good. But one of the things I think we've always presumed is that the PSA test itself is like, it has its own limitations, but it is a solid block. It's a bit of information. It's a number. It is what it is. But I think that that's probably an overestimate of exactly how reliable a single PSA test is, even within the uncertainty we accept. So what we want to talk about today is a slightly technical issue for the start. It's about the assays themselves, the PSA assays themselves, and, you know, how reliable is one assay compared to another assay, one lab compared to another lab. And we all understand that, yes, if you go to a different lab, you might get a slightly different result. But what we want to talk about this week is something that's become very apparent to us in the past few weeks, is that there can be really quite dramatic differences between one assay and another assay.
Almost enough that it would put them into another risk category.
Totally right. And so on this topic, we're going to welcome back a friend of the podcast and colleague here at Peter Mac, Associate Professor Daniel Moon. Daniel, welcome back.
Hi, Dick.
Great.
Hi, Renee.
Hi, Dan.
Nice to see you. Thanks very much for the invite.
Yeah, and, you know, shared WhatsApp messages between ourselves.
I've had my mind opened in the last few weeks because, like you, the PSA test has so many issues surrounding it, and we talk about its reliability and the reason, sensitivity, specificity, and how closely we should follow it and how much we should rely on it. But it's never occurred to me that the actual test itself needs a little careful analysis, because one test at one lab does not equal another test at another lab. And what has happened, even within the same laboratory, Dorovitch have thrown the cat among the pigeons in the last few weeks by introducing, unexpectedly, a second way of measuring the PSA. So suddenly the same patient will come to us and have two completely different PSA levels, and I am at a loss to tell him exactly what the PSA is. So that prompted a flurry of WhatsApp messages between us and a few other prominent prostate cancer specialists around Melbourne to see, hold on, have I missed a memo here? What's changed? What's going on? Why have I got such varying results, and how do I interpret this, and what do I tell my patients? And so, of course, we go to the source and we start to unlock secrets that we've really never understood. And that's exactly how you measure PSA and how it can be so different from one test to another.
Fantastic. That's a great summary to open us up there, Dan. And look, I think, you know, what probably happens out there is labs actually change their assays from time to time, and we're none the wiser, really. But Dorovitch, who, by the way, are really major providers here here in Melbourne, here in Australia, that we use a huge amount, actually changed their, brought in a new assay recently. But what they've been doing is reporting both assays on the same patient. So I think that's what really exposed it to us. If a lab had changed from one assay to another, and the numbers are a bit different, we're none the wiser because we don't have the other assay. But what's been happening with Dorovitch in the recent few weeks is we've got all these examples of patients, and they've had the PSA done on the 26th of October, and we get both. We get the PSA Atelica assay and the PSA Alinity assay.
Give me an
and they're very
Dick.
Different, and they're on the same report.
Give us an example.
I'll give you some examples. Okay, so here's a guy. This is all from the last couple of days. I've been printing these these off from my office. So here's a patient on active surveillance for low-risk prostate cancer. And his PSA, I've got it on the old assay for the past 2 years. It's 4.5, 4.9, 4.8, and now 5.2. So it's rock steady on the old assay. But on the new assay, because both are done on the same sample, it's 6.4. So that's a relatively modest increase. But the patient is very anxious about this because, you know, he's worried about being on surveillance and his PSA has gone up by, he's calculated, he's done a graph, he says it's gone up by 1.2, the doubling time is now this. And I'm trying to explain, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. Next example, you know, again, very similar. Patient on active surveillance, his PSA is very steady, 2.6, 2.5, 2.7, 2.8. This is rock steady for 3 years, except on the sample that was 2.8 last week, he's had it done on the Alinity, it's 3.7. Now, I know that's no big deal, but the patient is freaked out by that, et cetera, et cetera. There was one here where of a nice guy, he's a colleague in his late 70s, he's on active surveillance, got quite a few cardiac risk factors, but his PSA has gone from 10 to 11 to 15 to 17 done last week. And so I've been thinking of referring him for radiotherapy rather than ongoing surveillance, despite some risk factors he has. And so that was already our agreed plan. We knew he was heading that direction. So I, you know, I'm sending him off for radiotherapy. And so he would be intermediate risk by PSA criteria, intermediate risk prostate cancer. And he would have definitive radiotherapy, either straight or perhaps with 6 months neoadjuvant ADT. That's our standard of care for intermediate risk prostate cancer. But he's had the PSA assay done on the other one. So in the same sample, his PSA is 17.8, intermediate risk radiotherapy, but it's also 23 on the other assay, meaning he's now high risk prostate cancer by PSA criteria. It means he gets 2 years of castration with some cardiac risk factors and so on. So it fundamentally shifts the patient from one standard of care management to a different one because of the way we risk stratify our patients. So the PSA is 17.20. Anyway, I have loads of examples.
I mean,
of
the
that.
Reference ranges of the two assays are ever so slightly different, but it's still so hard to know what to make of the different readings.
Yeah.
So you have to wonder what the point is.
Exactly. So the best bit of this is now we have these fumbling urologists going on, you know, trying to explain all this. But we have brought an expert into the studio, into the discussion as well today, Renu and Dan. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Alan McNeil, a chemical pathologist who is a huge expertise in how all this works. And Alan is a lead chemical pathologist at Dorvich Pathology, our big provider, who are the ones whose examples I've been reading out, really trusted pathology providers of ours. And they're the ones who've made a decision recently to change their PSA assay from the PSA Atelica, we're going to learn a lot about this in the next few moments, to the PSA Alinity. And what they've been doing over this few months is doing both assays on, I think it's certain patients, Alan will tell us, patients who've had a history of PSA testing in Dorovich. When a new sample comes in, they're running both assays, I think, so they can see what differences are. And now it's really obvious to us what those differences are because of what myself and Dan have just been outlining. So Alan, welcome. Thank you for coming into Peter Mac to have a talk about this and joining us on GUCast today. So, you know, we've had a lot of chats with you in the past few weeks about all of this, but over to you. Look, tell us a bit about this whole thing.
Thank you for the invitation. I've got some explaining to do. So, where shall I start? I mean, I should start with how we measure PSA.
Yeah.
So, for those who don't know, so we use immunoassays. So, this is a technology that's been around for 50 years, and so what that means is that we're using antibodies, so the manufacturers have antibodies against PSA, usually two different antibodies, and the response between those antibodies and the patient's serum produces a signal that's translated to the PSA concentration that you get. That's all straightforward, right? Yeah. The issue is that in Australia there are four main manufacturers, and the reagents they use, the antibodies they use, all come from different sources. So there are commercial reasons for that. But what it means is that no two immunoassays are actually looking at the same thing. So the antibodies are looking at the shape of the PSA molecule, and there are variations in the shape and there are variations in the antibodies. So there are different epitopes on the PSA molecule that these antibodies recognise. So in the past, the differences between the PSA assays have been quite dramatic, and there have been moves to standardise and improve things, and those have been quite successful, but they haven't been perfect. And at the moment, there is a WHO standard that all the four large manufacturers in Australia use to standardise their PSA assays. So what they do is they make up their reagents and they use this standard. They show the standard to the assay and tell it, you know, this is X concentration. And then they, when it's been calibrated, they use that for patient samples. The problem is that even though they've done all that standardisation, when they look at patient samples, there are some differences. And so the reason is, I think deep down, is that the standard that has been created doesn't exactly match patient samples serum. So something to do with the purified PSA or the matrix that it's sitting in isn't quite the same as human samples. And I mean, human PSA samples are complicated. It's not like sodium or glucose. PSA is a large protein molecule. The amino acid sequence is going to vary between men. The you know, post-translational changes, so carbohydrate and things that are stuck on there, then PSA can be degraded in circulation. It's going to bind to protein. So it's not a simple thing. And this is part of the reason behind these differences you get. But the unfortunate reality is, despite the attempts of the manufacturers to standardise the PSA assay by using this common standard, results on patients tend to be different. And this has been brought to light with our recent change in assay, and I appreciate the anxieties and the concerns this has created for patients and urologists and doctors. But we've changed... Maybe I should go back another step to why we've changed assays. So at Dorevitch, we're part of one of the large laboratory networks across Australia, the Healius Network. And for the last, it must be almost 10 years, we've had a two-tier approach to PSA testing. So our standard platform for measuring most hormones and tumour markers is the Siemens Atelica. So this is a well-respected immunoassay platform. And so what happens is when patient samples come to the laboratory, they'll have their PSA, and PSA is requested, it'll be done on the Siemens Atelica first up. The problem with that assay, it's a very good assay, is that it's not very good at low concentrations. So we know as the concentration goes down, we measure the imprecision, which is the reproducibility, and it deteriorates at low concentrations. Now, this raises a whole other issue, which we might want to go to, about how important low PSA concentrations are.
Alan, sorry to interrupt. Sorry. But when you say low concentrations, are we now talking ultra-low concentrations? What levels?
0.2, less than 0.2.
Less than 0.2.
Yeah.
Because this brings in another whole interesting topic that dovetails into exactly this, is what we do with following men after prostate cancer treatment, particularly prostatectomy, in whom we are really... very much relying upon a PSA level to tell us the risk of cancer recurrence and to help guide further investigation and further treatment. And the problem is that men, particularly after radical prostatectomy, will often have very low but detectable PSA levels that can fluctuate. We believe that may be due to some benign glands left on the apex, which, because we really shell the sphincter out of the prostate to make sure that we preserve their continence, there may be benign glands left that produce a little bit of PSA.
Yep.
That's not cancer recurrence, but it may be detectable at low levels.
Yep.
And patients get very, very anxious about this because we can't really prove one way or another at a level that low. But no one likes seeing a detectable PSA when we have told them it should be zero after prostatectomy. So for that reason, we wonder whether or not we need to be measuring such low levels, because below a certain point, it doesn't mean it's cancer recurrence and it does create anxiety.
Yep. I guess this was all set off. The problem is things move fairly slowly, so oil tanker is on its way, and the whole idea that ultra-sensitive PSA might give an indication, you know, early indication of relapse and allows early treatment and so on, goes back many years, as you'd know. And I think, you know, I remember going to meetings, again, at least 10 years ago, where the ability to measure PSA at these low concentrations was seen as a technological advance. So the companies sort of... promoted this, and I think they've tried to get their assays measuring reliably at those low concentrations. I mean, we know that, as I said, with the Atelica assay, it's not so good down there, and because there's been a demand for those low concentrations, what we would do, and the other Healius labs, is any PSA below 0.11, we wouldn't report the Atelica result, we'd put the sample onto a second analyzer, the the Abbott Alinity, which has got better precision at low concentrations. Mm. So both the Abbott Alinity and the Roche system are very good down there, and they can actually read pretty consistently at three decimal places, so 0.005. And so what we would do is this two-tier approach. Men would have the PSA done by the Atelica. If it was below 0.11, it would go to the Alinity and they'd get an Alinity result. So that meant that men through our set of laboratories were getting this mixture of results. There's the whole thing about whether the low results are important or clinically relevant is another one. But from a lab point of view, that was undesirable because there's the cost and the trouble of maintaining two different systems. Yep. And then you've got to do quality control on it. And then there's a risk of increased errors and it slows the passage of specimens through the lab. So we were, I guess, trying to do the right thing, but it was, from a laboratory point of view, suboptimal.
So you have two groups that, unfortunately, I don't think have adequately been communicating, because you have pathologists who are trying to do the right thing. They're striving for excellence, striving to produce the lowest detectable, most sensitive PSA levels you can, but without talking to clinicians, us, and it's as much our fault as it is yours, we don't want ultra low. We don't want to know if a PSA goes three decimal places, 0.02 to 0.03, because that just creates a lot of anxiety, and it creates absolutely no salvage treatment investigation, or worse, it may create more salvage treatment or investigation when it's completely unnecessary. We would far prefer a higher cutoff, say 0.1, because below that, it's really meaningless. And I spend a lot of time, and Deccan, Renu, you can tell me your experience, but I spend a lot of time counselling men whose PSA is fluctuating in that 0.02, 0.03, 0.08, 0.04 range, when it's clinically meaningless.
I think the problem is that, like you've said, Alan, ultra-sensitive PSA has been around for a long, long time. Mm. And there's been a lot of literature published talking about, you know, lead time advantage and trying to predict the earliest time of biochemical recurrence. But we've got a lot of evidence now that anything below 0.1 doesn't matter. Mm. And the problem is continuing to do that feeds into patient anxiety. And like you say, Dan, I mean, if we see a patient every 3 months, they would have had 10 PSA readings in that time. And all it does is worsen that problem that you were saying of maintaining, lab costs and consistency and minimizing errors.
And that's where I think probably we've had a failure to communicate between, the clinicians involved in prostate cancer and the lab experts in this area. Because as our colleague Nathan Laurentiuk mentioned to us this morning at MDT, it seems to him, seems to us like an arms race by the pathology assay people to the bottom, trying to get down to three decimal points. And for the lab industry to think that it matters that we measure down to three decimal points is a failure for us to communicate that it doesn't matter. And maybe 10, 15 years ago when the assays were being developed, it might have mattered. But the really big thing, as we've talked about in this podcast a lot in the past 12 months, is that there's now really strong evidence to prove that it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because ultrasensitive assay was only ever really important for the post-prostatectomy patient whose prostate's out. There should be no PSA. And if there is detectable PSA, then salvage radiotherapy or we'll call it post-operative radiotherapy would be a high standard of care. And up to a few years ago, we would consider giving radiotherapy to people with high-risk features. In other words, there's a positive margin or there's T3 cancer, even if the PSA was undetectable. And 0.2 remains the definition of biochemical recurrence, despite the ultrasensitive assays.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because we don't trust the assays below 0.2, but now also three pivotal trials published in The Lancet just over a year ago have shown that it doesn't matter if you wait until the PSA reaches 0.2 and offer what we call early salvage radiotherapy compared to giving radiotherapy below 0.2, which we call adjuvant radiotherapy. So it might be detectable on an ultrasensitive assay, But now that standard of care is gone based on these three randomized trials, at least for the populations included in those trials, which is most of our patients. So we no longer care because we're never going to offer those patients treatment until the PSA gets to 0.2. And sure, I think it's probably helpful if we know it's 0.1 and we can have that conversation and so on. But the levels below that, I suspect that's just a conversation that the clinical community haven't had with the lab community.
And is this the first time a biochemist has spoken to a urologist in about a decade of...
This needs to happen more often.
I guess defending the process is this thing just about lead time. And so I guess when the enthusiasm appears back 20 years ago, then the manufacturing effort, which is not inconsiderable, this is a thing in Europe and the US and so on, starts up. And I guess there's a commercial imperative for them as well. And so by the time that's appeared... At that same time, the trials are happening.
So they've got a lag time disadvantage, almost,
That's right. But since then, of course, too, the other impact at that 0.2 level is that now one in five of those men, we will find a spot outside the pelvis on a PET scan. Yeah. And that will also significantly change management. So it may ultimately be that if you wait, you'll see that they're not candidates for radiation.
So I suppose, Dan, that's back to the conversation that we never rely on a single PSA and we have a multivariable approach. However, dumb urologists still presume that the number is still a very reliable, reproducible number. Yeah. And if it is 0.1 or 0.0, it is what it is. But I think that's what's really interesting talking to Alan about this and our conversations in recent weeks. It's just a reminder to us that we and you're not surprised by this, that the assays are... There's variability, and you've very nicely explained why that is. There are industrial reasons why there is, but also you've confirmed to us that at these lower levels, it's particularly so. So I think we have to have two conversations about it. One is about the ultra-low PSAs, and we are now really trying to start a conversation globally about that, pushing back against it. And it'll be particularly reinforced by our increasing understanding that they're very unreliable at these lower and lower levels. And then we'll help communicate back to industry and say, well, we'd much prefer a very reliable assay, reproducible, even inter-assay reproducibility, rather than an unreliable one at low levels, which no longer helps us anymore.
Right. I mean, that second problem, maybe I should go to that, is going to be hard to address, because I guess our attempts to get around this two-tier system and have one assay meant that we chose, in this case, the Abbott Alinity assay, which is a very good assay. And the process you're talking about, this sort of re-baselining, men who'd we'd seen in the last 2 years, we would run their sample by the old and the new assays and give you the two results, to give you some feel of what it was going to be like with the new assay. And this is the other problem, so that the Abbott Alinity tends to read a bit higher, similar to the Roche assay, whereas the Siemens assay and the Beckman assay, these are two other large manufacturers, tend to read a bit lower. Wow. And in the range sort of under 5 micrograms per litre, there can be a 25% difference with the Alinity result higher than the Siemens Atelica result. So now this comes back to another problem of how the results are interpreted. And if you use a fixed cutoff, so for example, in the Australian NHNMRC guidelines, they talk about 3.0 as a cutoff, and you're mentioning 20 and so on. These fixed cutoffs don't take into account the fact that there's well-documented lab variability and methods. So I know it makes everyone's life just, overly complicated, but the fact is that to use one fixed cutoff with PSAs is just wishful thinking, to tell the truth. So with glucose, maybe you can do that, but with PSA, you can't. So that's the other aspect. So the one aspect's to do with these low concentrations and the practical difficulties this created with labs trying to provide the service, which maybe wasn't as necessary as we thought. Yeah. But then it's revealed this other problem to do with the between assay variation. Now PSA is not the first test where this occurs, and so immunoassays, for example, with ferritin don't agree that well, and there are differences which come as a surprise to clinicians. And there are other assays which are similar. So, yeah.
Do you think there should be some sort of circular when changes like this are initiated, perhaps from Dorovitch to interest groups such as the Urological Society and...
Look, I think that would have been good. Maybe that's something we didn't do
You can still do, actually, and I think the podcast will help. But, you know, for us, we're spending a lot of time, a huge amount of time, sitting with these results, explaining them, or trying to explain them to patients, and we're getting messages from other urologists saying, have you noticed this? And I, you know, one of our radiation oncologists, Scott Williams, messaged me last night about the same thing, and again, reinforcing some of the points we made about the low PSAs. But I think we'll need to do something. It'll educate ourselves as well, Alan, as well as help us educate our patients about the impact of this. But, even you know, you guys are good at communicating out these things.
Yes, the other thing Renu mentioned was about the reference intervals changing, and we have done that. So one of the things of moving to the Alinity is that's probably one of the most commonly used PSA assays around Australia, which has some advantages with patient mobility and so on. But one thing that's happened in Australia is that the laboratories using that method have come up with harmonised age-specific reference intervals. And so there are some suggestions given out by the manufacturer, but I think it was maybe 2009, the laboratories got together and agreed on a set of reference intervals that go up in five-year increments. And, you know, differences between reference intervals have been a major problem in biochemistry and PSA. And one advantage with the Alinity assay is these common reference intervals, which will be, I think, useful. With the number of men flagged abnormal, even though the PSA results have gone up, the number flagged abnormal hasn't actually changed that much. So while in the important group of men with PSAs under 5 micrograms per litre, they've gone up, some men with higher concentrations, it hasn't changed that much. And also with the changes in the age-specific ranges, the numbers who have got a star next to their result saying it's abnormal, some have gone up and some have gone down. So that's another aspect with the change of that assay.
And I know you've got good data. You've shared with us a graph because, of course, you're experts at quality and data. And so you've got a bunch of patients now that you're running both assays on.
Yes.
So you can measure the variability, and you've talked to us about the standard deviations. I mean, we're showing you some examples, but they seem to be not rare. All the examples we're seeing in clinics and in rooms, there's huge variations and confusion. But can you talk to us a bit about the actual standard deviations you're seeing between them?
Sure. There are two things. I mean, one, Dan had a patient where there was, I think, quite a big difference. So, you know, there are these 20% differences that are quite common. But then I think he'd sent through one man where the new PSA on the Alinity was maybe 60 or 80% higher.
Yeah, there's one in the initial old one was something like 2.6, Dan, then 4.7 or something quite different.
So what we've done is we've gone back, we'd check both of those. So because he contacted us, we've got the serum, re-ran it again with both assays, and the results, I think, were much the same. There may be some small differences. And it seems when we plot men's results with the old and new assays, there's a standard difference with some noise between it. But there are one or two men who seem to be outliers where there's really quite a big difference. Now, what that means, I don't know. The two sets of antibodies used in the assays are picking up some difference in their PSA, whether that's a genetic thing or some post-translational thing or a malignant thing, I don't know. But this ended up, I think there was a group of maybe 3 in 1,000 of the spots. So it was well less than 1%. But these immunoassays have showed up some other unknowns. Related to the variability, that's important too. So in the laboratory, we run quality control samples. So we have three levels with tumour markers. So for PSA, we have one around 0.2 micrograms per litre, one about 2, and maybe one around 20. So the idea is to have concentrations that are around important decision points. And so what we'll do is every run, we will put these on and see what results they get. And then we plot out a thing called a Levi-Jennings plot, which shows a standard deviation. So we know from past experience what average result we'll get and what deviation we'll accept. And there are a whole set of quality control rules. If that result is outside 2 standard deviations, we'll hold the results. If it's outside 3, we know there's a problem. So there's this whole thing about laboratory quality control. For example, we're compelled, not only do we choose the levels at appropriate points, but also we must use third-party quality control material. So often with an Abbott assay, there might be Abbott quality control materials they provide. We're not allowed to use those unless it's a last resort, because they often tend to be surprisingly good. So, I mean, these are part of the laboratory regulations in Australia. So with PSA, for example, the imprecision, the reproducibility of our 0.2 microgram per litre standard is maybe plus or minus 0.01, so it's about 5%, right?
What are you measuring that on? What's the serum that you use for quality control?
Well, it's an artificial serum, so it's got to be stable, it's got to be consistent. So this is provided by Bio-Rad.
It's human serum.
No. They try to make it... We try to make it commutable, meaning that it's as like human serum as possible, but because it's a preserved sample and some of these are freeze-dried and so on, it can't be. But they try to...
But as you said earlier on, human serum varies from these artificial ones because it doesn't have the differences in the degradations.
You're right, but what we're doing with the quality control is we're looking for reproducibility rather than accuracy.
Okay.
So the fact that the 0.2 might be different from a 0.3 or a 0.4 doesn't matter so much as consistency. So what we're talking about here, there's two aspects. One is how accurate, which is how close you are to the target. The other is reproducibility, which is when you shoot the arrows onto the target board, how close they are to each other, right? So with these samples, we know the reproducibility is around 5%, plus or minus 5%. As far from a clinical point of view, why that's important is if you have a man who's having repeated measurements in the same, with the same method, the same laboratory, you're going to have that analytical variation there. It's always going to vary by plus or minus 5%, right? In addition to that, there's biological variation. So as with other biological things, weight and respiratory rate and heart rate and so on, there's biological variation. And with PSA, there have been various studies. Some say it's 5%, some say it's more like 15%. But you can't get away from that either. So that means if a man has a PSA done now and then he has it done in a month's time, you've got to, and you want to say, are these results, are they different? So it's gone from 0.15 to 0.17. Is it really different? You've got to take into account the 5% analytical variation. And in addition to that, you've got to take into account the 5 or more percent biological variation. And there are various formulas for doing that. And what it means is that you're probably looking at around a 20% change before it's a real detectable difference between the results. So when you see, you know, it's usually an inexperienced clinician goes and overinterprets the results. They see 1.1 goes to 1.2 and they're going and getting excited about it. You say, just hold on, you're not taking these things into account. And so in laboratories, as I say, we measure analytical variation. It's not accuracy. And we've got, not only do we see this 5%, we've got to take into account the fact that in our laboratory, for example, there are 6 analyzers doing PSA. They might read slightly differently. And when a patient's sample comes in, we don't know if it's going to go to analyzer 1 or analyzer 5. And then when they come back for the repeat visit in 3 months' time, those analyzers might have drifted a little bit. They're on a new lot of reagent. There's a new operator. It's a new, different time of day. So I think people must be aware of this variation.
That's one of the most important things you've said. This is a stark reminder to me about understanding that variation. And I kind of get that. But a lot of our patients don't. And, of course, we all have some patients who are completely obsessed with the number. And they're repeating them, whether they have prostate cancer or don't, you know, weekly, monthly, you know. And so I think we need to do better as well as clinicians to help educate patients about the variability.
I mean, I think, from everything you've said, Alan, I think that... the variability between assays and even within the same assay, it's kind of inevitable.
Yes.
Almost accepted.
And I think we've always accepted that variability in pre-treatment PSA. And luckily we have a lot of other things that we can use other than PSA to assess clinical risk. The frustration, I think, is post-treatment.
Yeah.
It used to be that we could just see less than 0.1, less than 0.1, less than 0.1, and that would be consistent. But now we're seeing so many different numbers.
Right.
And it's very hard.
It's only hard to renew. It's potentially damaging. I had to give a medico-legal opinion on a man who was treated interstate who had radiation therapy for a PSA change after prostatectomy that went up to 0.02, received radiation at such a low level and then was made permanently incontinent. And so when decisions made, if that variability is not understood and the significance of such a low level is not really appreciated, then real harm can be done to men.
Just like you said, someone with slightly less experience might jump on a PSA going from 1.1 to 1.2. Yes. And the thing is, we always say, it doesn't matter if it's less than 0.1. But it's not just that it doesn't matter, it has a ripple effect.
Absolutely. I mean, there have been attempts by laboratories to communicate this, and the problem is reports are crowded already. There's a whole been a movement in laboratories talking about measurement uncertainty, and some of the purists say that every single one of our results should have a measurement uncertainty with it. So, for example, a sodium result. So you're going to not only have the 140, it's going to say plus or minus 1 millimole per litre. I mean, the place that it has stuck is in toxicology. So a drug level that's below a cutoff and is going to mean someone's employment has changed, that takes into account. But maybe something like PSA, I guess experts often have a tacit feel for it. So they've seen thousands of patients and they get a feel for it. And I think the difference is the novice or the patient when they're given their results. I mean, patients having the results is very good for their empowerment, but then understanding some of the subtleties is important too.
Especially when they've had treatment and they're just waiting for the cancer to come back.
And that's what, you know, we often joke that PSA stands for patient stress and anxiety, and it does, because they're getting, and I keep on my desktop an example of a patient post-prostatectomy many years ago. PSA was less than 0.03. That was the race to the bottom at the time, and then it became 0.03, 0.04, 0.05, 0.06, 0.07 every 3 months. I thought, oh God, he's probably is heading for biochemical recurrence, and then it just reversed course and became undetectable.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I keep it on my desktop because when I have all these patients coming in with a PSA of 0.06, really worried about it, I'll think, look, here's an example, calm down, don't worry. Of course, we're going to watch it just in case, but let me tell you, as Renu just said, if it just said your PSA is less than 0.1, nobody would lose from that. Nobody would
and
lose.
And you could do a PSA every 6 months.
No one's anxious. There's no patient stress and anxiety.
Right.
And then when
still
it gets to the point, we're watching it. When it gets to point. So look, I think that's one of our main messages. We're going to go on this renewed campaign in the post trial era of radical.
Statistically empowered.
Say, let's drop ultra-sensitive PSA
You know, it's funny,
Dick,
because the labs used to race because you'd want to go to the provider that offered the best test, right? So previously we'd be going to the one that offered the lowest test. Now if a lab says we're stopping measuring under 0.1,
it is a mess. And I think that's part of the communication.
Ignorance is bliss.
There you go.
But that was so interesting, Alan, though. I mean, I think you've explained that, especially in the pre-treatment PSA, that variability.
And look, I'd love to be sitting here in a year or two's time when we've had position statements and new comments that we'll write, because we like writing papers, pushing against, and then maybe one lab will come out or offer us the option to tick a box saying no undetectable.
Yeah.
Would it be cheaper to do is it cheaper to do assays? But not really anymore, probably. But look, I think it would not affect patient management. So that's one issue. The second issue, though, finally, I know there'll be people listening wondering, okay, what is the story? So, I mean, this is part of a switch to the Alinity anyway, and you will stop reporting them both. So what is the plan, just out of interest, so we stop getting both assays?
Well, they'll just be pure Alinity ones. So the Helios laboratories, you'll end up with Alinity all the time.
From when?
So from now. Yes.
From now.
So,
because these are all up to last week.
It opens up a whole more complicated thing about sensitivity and specificity of results. I don't know if you want to go there, but that's a whole thing. If you've got a person who's on average got higher results, what does that mean? I mean, if the Alinity assay gives higher PSAs than the Roche assay, for example, what does that mean? And I think what it probably means, if you then go to follow through to pathological endpoints, that the Alinity assay is probably more sensitive but also less specific. So it's going to be picking up more disease but at a cost of more noise.
We can cope with that. We can cope with that. Honestly, we can, because we correct for Renew. I'm thinking of the example of patients we start on Duodart, for example.
Yeah.
We know that drops their PSA. So in our minds, if we've got a patient on Duodart and we're also checking their PSAs, we're thinking, right, we started Duodart last year. We expect the PSA will be around 50% lower. We're good at that. But if we had a really clear message coming out now to say, we, a huge lab group, have switched to this assay. And it's written in the small print, but we could message it better. Understand that this may mean your patient's PSA level may be up to 25% higher than before. We'll adjust for that. We have no problem. And I think, honestly, once we switch to the other one and there's only one, it's been very good of you to be running both, but this is what's created the real problem for us is that.
Right.
And if you switch to the other one, it'll be and drop the other one, drop the Atelica, it'll be really important to simultaneously message to, because we won't have the dual information to say clinicians and patients understand we've switched to an assay, and typically this tends to report levels about 20-25% higher. Simple message, and then we can adjust for that in the way we do our
multi-variable. It's all about just comparing apples and apples and continuing to do that, you know, in the future.
Dan, you started all this off by firing off these WhatsApp messages.
I've learned a lot.
What do you think? Are we getting clearer on it?
I think so. I've learned a lot already this morning, and
yeah,
I feel a bit more wiser in counselling patients about these numbers. And hopefully this will start a whole new relationship between our biochemical colleagues and
educate us. Yeah, these fumbling urologists. But it's been very helpful. It really has. You. But I think we need to do a bit more work in communicating it, probably position statements between experts like yourself, Alan, and clinicians who rely on PSA assays to make decisions. And I think that'll be a really useful conversation. And separately to that, we're trying to push the world back away from ultrasensitive assays anyway, which might make life easier for you.
Yes.
And I mean, for example, if we weren't doing ultrasensitive assays, would you have cared about this? Because it sounds to me like the trigger to move was based on your concerns about the ultrasensitive. Yeah. And if you'd come to us, we would have said, forget about it. If you told us you're only doing 0.1, we would have been happy.
Can you get a refund?
Anyway, there you go. Renu, that was fantastic.
That was awesome.
Do you feel educated on the
Absolutely. The I always do, but this was... I almost wish I'd recorded Alan. We could just play that back to patients who go, oh, my PSA went from 0.5 to 0.6.
Well, maybe we should be doing a CME module as well and trying to... We could ask people a few questions afterwards to say, you know, what did you remember about blah, blah, blah?
Yeah.
Anyway,
thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you. And that's all we have time for here on GUcast today. It's been great to be back talking about this topic, and we look forward to diving in when we finally kill off ultrasensitive PSA next year. We're starting our global campaign
today.
You heard
it here first.
Exactly. And Nathan Laurentiuk's arms race to the bottom. We're going to put an end to it very soon. Talk to you again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.